So with that, I think we're going to kick things off, and I'm going to turn it over to Melissa Friedland from EPA Superfund Program. Go ahead, Melissa.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Am I close enough to the microphone?
Yep, sure.
Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. I'm Melissa Friedland. I'm the Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment, and this is one of a series of monthly webinars on CLUIN that we started last April as part of our efforts to celebrate the 10th anniversary of SRI, as we fondly call it. We've been working to offer timely Superfund redevelopment topics and share reuse case studies from across the country. I always like to say, to give a commercial, that our next webinar series will continue on December 10th, followed by one on January 21st. We will not have a webinar presentation in November. So last month, Fran Costanzi, who is the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 8, presented a fantastic look at the redevelopment taking place at the Midvale Slag site in Utah. Her presentation focused on the critical relationship between local government and EPA and returning Midvale Slag to productive use. So this month, we'd like to continue our discussion of working with local governments on Superfund redevelopment. And here with us today is Ken Patterson, who's the Director of Regional Support Division in the Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement. He's going to present CERCLA liability protections for local government. And we also have John Podgursky, the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in Region 1, who's going to basically introduce Jim Rocco, a contractor from Vita Nova, and they'll be discussing the new risk evaluation workbook for communities. So thank you all very much for joining us. I'm looking forward to your presentations. And Ken, we'll start with you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Melissa. And Jean, let me ask you again as our moderator. I have gotten closer to the speaker phone. Will this work, as I was hoping to have two colleagues here in the room be able to hear the presentations also? Is this adequate, my speaking voice using the speaker?
Yes, Kenneth, you sound a lot better now. This is perfectly fine. Thank you.
Should that change, let me know and I can pick up the handset.
Will do.
Good afternoon, everyone. Melissa, thank you for the introduction there. As the Superfund Enforcement Office at EPA headquarters, we work quite closely with the Office of Site Remediation and Technology Innovation, of which Melissa is a part, and we work closely with their umbrella office, OSWER, on all of the nation's hazardous waste cleanup laws. Our office is pretty much, if you'll go to the next slide, which would be slide number 2. Our office is uniquely situated to comment on issues related to liability protections for local governments because not only are we the Superfund Enforcement Office at headquarters charged with enforcing EPA's hazardous waste laws, including RCRA and CERCLA and the corrective action provisions of RCRA, we're also the office that works both with the Brownfields office at EPA, OSRIDI, and our regional office on promoting Brownfields redevelopment by clarifying liability for parties who are interested in becoming involved in the ownership or operation of a site that has had hazardous waste implications to it, either a CERCLA or a RCRA site. So that's a key role that our office plays, and I manage half of that office, Office of Site Remediation Enforcement, the half that works directly with our regional offices when site-specific issues come up related to either liability or redevelopment. As many of you know, I'm sure, in 2002, Congress passed the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act, and the purpose of these Brownfields amendments were to clarify and were to modify CERCLA and to clarify landowner liability concerns, as well as the providing of grants and for funding of assessment and cleanup of contaminated properties. Our office provides guidance on the liability protections of those laws, and I would ask you to check out our website, which you'll have as a resource at the end of this presentation, and look at such documents as our revitalization handbook that gives an overview of the intersection, as we see it in our office, between enforcement of the polluter pays principle behind CERCLA and the promotion of redevelopment. So if you go to the next slide, today what we're focusing on is the local goal, the government's role in the cleanup and redevelopment of contaminated properties. We recognize that local governments play a very important role in getting these abandoned, idle sites that cause a blight to neighborhoods and communities, and they inhibit economic development as well as threatening public health and the environment. Local governments play a very important role to getting these sites back into productive reuse. And communities across the country are struggling with how to clean up and revitalize these sites. And there are, as you know, many of you know, if you're working in local governments or advise or counsel them, they have to acquire contaminated sites under their police power or other operation of their local laws, such as a sheet or tax foreclosure. They acquire these properties in a number of different ways, and so it's very important for EPA to work together with local governments to help them understand the nature of the liability they might assume, and particularly where they don't assume liability because of either the operation of law, because of something in the Brownfields Amendment or other parts of the CERCLA law that says they're not liable if they take on this property, as well as why they're not liable because EPA chooses as a matter of its enforcement discretion not to pursue them, even though perhaps we could. So that's a very important and timely topic given not only the interest in brownfields right now, if you go to the next slide, the interest in brownfields right now, but also in the current economic situation with tax foreclosures increasing in many, if not all, areas of the country. It's a particularly timely topic for us to talk about. One thing I'd like to point out, and this is on that next slide, slide number four, it's always important for people who work for local governments or counsel or advise them to remember that federal EPA's involvement in the vast majority of contaminated properties is unlikely. The lower risk brownfield sites are, and indeed some with higher risk components to them, are addressed primarily by state brownfield and voluntary cleanup programs. And EPA doesn't get involved in the vast majority of brownfield site cleanups and transactions. We have the lead principally, though not totally, at the more highly contaminated properties such as the sites on the national priorities list. To give you some numbers here, there are only about 1,500 sites on the national priorities list for EPA, compared to an estimated 450,000 identified brownfield sites in the country. And many of those 1,500 sites on the national priorities list are mature sites. They're not the kind that are right now the subject of discussions about liability concerns. If you'll turn to the next slide. We appreciate that despite that reality of EPA's federal involvement, or EPA's federal attention to brownfield sites or other sites that have contamination that local governments choose or have to get involved in, that there is still a fear of perceived liability that there could be potential EPA enforcement actions, and that fear may impact local governments' decisions to acquire contaminated properties. One thing I will point out, and I can't stress this strongly enough, EPA is not looking to play gotcha with local government entities. We are not, those local governments who act responsibly in how they take possession of and maintain involvement in contaminated sites, we have no desire to go after them for liability. One thing that is often confused in folks' minds are the brownfields eligibility requirements for grants and revolving loan funds. Those requirements say that any municipal entity who is a responsible party at a Superfund site isn't eligible to get a grant. Congress decided that when it set forth that pool of money, that cities or individuals who are PRPs or responsible parties under Superfund should be paying for that liability out of their own funds and not out of any government grant or loan programs. EPA is pretty strict on interpreting that provision of the law because we feel like under the grant requirements we have to be. But the fact that we may say that a city is not eligible to receive a grant doesn't mean that our next step or even our desire is to turn around and pursue that city for and take enforcement actions because of their ownership of the property. If you could turn to the next or flip to the next slide, please. It's good for those of you who aren't regular CERCLA practitioners, and maybe a reminder for those of you who are more familiar with it, to for me to set the climate for why local governments or indeed any entity involved with a Superfund site in the site's history is justifiably concerned about about the liability scheme because it's very broad. CERCLA's liability is strict, meaning it is without regard to fault. It is without regard to whether the party obeyed all existing laws at the time that it acquired or owned the property. It is not a fault-based statute. It is strict liability. If you meet one of the categories of Superfund liability, that you are either an owner, an operator, a generator, or a transporter to a Superfund site, you are liable under the definitions in CERCLA 107 without regard to fault. The liability is also joint and several, which means basically that if there are 10 parties who are liable for a Superfund site, those parties EPA can pursue those parties individually or all together, and we may pursue any one party for all of the liability at the site, and not sue the other parties. Now, as a matter of practice, EPA does not do this. We are very concerned with being fair and equitable at sites, but that the liability provided for under the court's interpretation of the CERCLA statute is joint and several. And under CERCLA 107, and the reason this is such a relevant topic for municipalities, is that the current owner of a contaminated property can be liable for cleanup costs. If you take ownership of the property, the possibility exists that you can be liable for all of the often very expensive cleanup costs, even if you've done nothing to cause the contamination at that site. Now, that liability is strict, joint, and several, but as I reminded you, or as I stated earlier, EPA can and does exercise its enforcement discretion in deciding whether to pursue certain parties, including local governments. And our internal research in that regard shows that EPA enforcement actions against local governments that are acquiring brownfield sites, the focus of our discussion today, that enforcement actions against local governments who acquired brownfield sites for redevelopment and reuse are extremely rare. In addition to our enforcement discretion, and obviously as important, CERCLA provides a number of defenses to liability. So in addition to the comfort we can offer up by saying that we're not in the business of seeking out local governments and finding a way to find them liable when they've acted responsibly, in addition, local governments have statutory provisions that protect them. If you go to the next slide, number 7, please. We think a lot of the existing liability protections or defenses under CERCLA should address many of the concerns that local governments have regarding potential liability. For example, CERCLA protects local governments from liability if they obtain property involuntarily. We'll discuss all of these in future slides in this presentation. Secondly, if the contamination has been caused solely by the acts of a third party, and you'll see the statutory references for each of these. Third, a municipality or any other entity who qualifies as a bona fide prospective purchaser gets the protections of that provision of the law as long as they comply with the requirements thereof. Next, the local government isn't liable if it is conducting a cleanup of a brownfield pursuant to a state cleanup program, most of which are called voluntary cleanup programs. And last, there's a provision of CERCLA that attaches to cities or local government entities alone, and that is associated with a site that a city doesn't own, but has to go on to take a response to some type of an emergency occurring at the facility, such as a fire. One message I want to stress here is when you look at these defenses, one I'd like you to focus on as you examine these statutory provisions is the bona fide prospective purchaser one, and we'll talk about that one. But particularly that's one that is pretty much a catch-all. If you have any doubts about whether or not any of these other provisions might attach to a municipality with which you are involved or one that you are advising, I would urge you to try to comply with the bona fide prospective purchaser provisions. Now, let's talk about the different ones that I listed here. Let me check in with my moderator here. Am I going fast enough? Is this a pace suiting you okay, Madam Moderator?
They're certainly fine. Go ahead and keep going at this pace. Just a reminder, we're about 20 minutes into the two-hour seminar, and you're on slide number 7.
But he only has
half. I appreciate that. That's the kind of being kept honest I need. The slide number 8, involuntary acquisition. This is what I'd like to talk with you about now. The first of the defenses that I referred to in the earlier slide. This provision provides an exemption from CERCLA owner or operator liability, and I set forward on the slides that the exact statutory language that considered within the definition of a liable owner or operator, we do not include a unit of state or local government which acquired ownership or control of property involuntarily through bankruptcy, tax delinquency, abandonment, or other circumstances in which the government involuntarily acquires title by virtue of its function as a sovereign. So, that statutory provision operates if you meet those delineated definitions, bankruptcy, tax delinquency, abandonment, per se, and then, as you'll hear as we discuss the case law, there are also other circumstances in which the government involuntarily acquires title. You'll note the absence in the statute of the exact words eminent domain, which is an important distinction that we'll get into later. Now remember, this exclusion does not apply to any state or local government that caused or contributed to the release or threatened release of a hazardous substance. The thing to remember about involuntary acquisition, and it's relevant to the next slide on land banks, which we'll get to in a moment, the thing to remember about these types of normal government, local government activities that result in them owning property, taking title or control of property, is there is a continuum to the voluntariness of them. If you think about a tax foreclosure, a piece of property on which taxes are owed is a delineated piece of property. If you own that property and you don't pay the taxes, that's the property the city has to foreclose against. They can't go foreclose against some other piece of property instead of that one. So that's an involuntary decision there when you owe taxes. Now, there's a level of voluntariness to it from the perspective that the city may or may not choose to exercise its rights. But if they choose to exercise it, it's about that piece of property. Then let's think about something a little less involuntary. A city wants to build a road, and it can either go through a section of the community that has large houses owned by some of the finest citizens and elementary schools through it, or it can go all the way around that area at considerably greater expense. The city chooses one rather than the other one for either either because they want to spend less money or they want to make a smaller number of people mad. There's a level of voluntary aspect to that when they choose which property they're going to go against. And then on that continuum, you go a little bit further when you're talking about the mere decision that some property is better property for the purposes that you may be attempting to further. For example, there's a state land bank, and you can pick property from that land bank and choose what to take title to, and some of that is closer, let's say, to the waterfront or to some highway or something else that makes it more valuable property to take possession of. Again, a little less voluntary because you move from the perspective of the things that typically cities worry about, like keeping its citizens happy and safe, to things that are more about making money. So there's a wide aspect, a wide continuum here. And if you'll go to the next slide, that's why I wanted to particularly talk about land banks a little bit, because an increasing number of states and municipalities are passing legislation to develop land banks. The way those operate is they set up these governmental or non-governmental entities that assemble and temporarily manage vacant, abandoned, and tax-delinquent properties in order to find a way to convert them to productive use. And we recommend in those types of situations that local governments minimize their potential liability from land bank acquisitions. Again, remember, I'm talking about this is a little less of an arguably involuntary acquisition because they're picking certain properties over others. But one way they can minimize that, if they're concerned that they may not get the protection of the involuntary acquisition exemption from CERCLA liability, is to conduct all appropriate inquiry, which sort of sets them up to be bona fide prospective purchasers. Now, if you go to the next slide, there are a lot of case-specific facts and state laws that help determine back to the involuntary acquisition discussion. That we'll get to some state and other case law in a moment that better clarifies that, but let me talk a little bit now about some of the other defenses. The third-party defense, also known as the innocent landowner defense, is often a very difficult one for any party to show, whether it's a municipality or not, because the contamination has to have occurred before the government entity acquired the property. The government entity has to exercise due care with respect to all that contamination, and the government entity has to take precautions against certain acts of the party that caused the contamination. The reason this is a very difficult one for local government entities to demonstrate is you're not covered by the third-party defense as a local government if you have a contractual relationship with the owner, with the liable owner from which you took the property. And contractual relationships include land contracts, deeds, easement, leases, or other instruments transferring title or possession. So when you're in an area that's not a truly involuntary, or in a situation that's not a truly involuntary acquisition, as I referred to earlier, and you're actually negotiating a contract to buy a piece of land from someone, In those situations, the contractual relationship may vitiate the third-party defense. So it's not particularly useful in the gray areas that we've been discussing. If you'll go to slide number 11, eminent domain, there is, however, eminent domain is an area. I said it's not covered in the express list of situations that are listed in the involuntary acquisition definition, but eminent domain is where it gets sort of gray, and the overlap between eminent domain and third-party defense becomes relevant. And there are, this is the area where you have to look to state law in determining whether the transaction of eminent domain that is done under eminent domain meets the definition of involuntary acquisition. There are a couple of case examples there. One of them, Emeryville. The city was negotiating with the owners to buy the property, but they weren't able to agree on a price. So the city went through eminent domain procedures to buy the, to take the property, quote, involuntarily. And the court held that this did qualify as eminent domain covered by as a more involuntary act, and thus the city wasn't liable. However, in the city of Toledo, the other case, this was a contribution action, the city argued that property that was ultimately purchased by them was covered by eminent domain, and the court held that it didn't qualify for eminent domain because while they had as their backup plan to take eminent domain control of the property, they actually bought it in a negotiated sale. The court said, hey, what you thought about doing is not what's relevant, it's what you did. A state law determination as to the definition of eminent domain. If you'll turn to the next slide, there's another case that we talk about there called City of Wichita versus Arrow Holdings. In that case, the city argued that it purchased property involuntarily, quote, in lieu of condemnation, and they stated that in the purchase agreement. Again, similar to the last case, they argued that if the sale hadn't occurred, they would have condemned the property pursuant to its eminent domain power. And the court rejected this argument, saying that the city voluntarily purchased the property, that it had evaluated the property and was well aware that it was contaminated and was a potential source of groundwater condemnation. And I want to read to you if you'll forgive me for just reading to you for a moment, there's some language that's particularly relevant in the city and the dicta of the court. It says, while only a sovereign can acquire property through exercise of eminent domain, such an acquisition is not involuntary, at least as far as the sovereign is concerned. In the case of bankruptcy, tax delinquency, and abandonment, a state or local government acquires rights to property through some type of inaction on the part of the landowner. In an acquisition through eminent domain, the property is acquired because of some characteristic desirable to the government entity, and affirmative steps are taken to acquire the property for some specific use. So again, that's the case law fine point on the tension that we often see play out in the eminent domain area. And then finally, if you'll go to the next slide, slide 13, U.S. versus Occidental Chemical Corporation, you will remember what famous site was in the city of Niagara Falls, no doubt, the poster child for our program, Love Canal. And in that case, the city of Niagara Falls argued that in purchasing property to build roads and a park, that it was making an involuntary purchase because these are functions that a sovereign must perform. The court found, though, that the city's definition of involuntary is inconsistent with CERCLA, since, quote, all municipal purchases are made for the benefit of citizens. And the city's construction of the word involuntary would cause the exception to swallow the rule. The court did go on to point out that a closer question might have been presented if the city had acquired the property through eminent domain. So, again, I'm not saying this makes it any clearer. I'm saying there is a full range of case law that needs to be examined before relying on eminent domain as an example of involuntary acquisition that's not liable. Next slide. In the area of involuntary acquisition, EPA has tried through a couple of mechanisms over the years to clear up the involuntary acquisition area somewhat. We published in 1992 the lender liability rule, and in a second half of that rule, we talked about the agency's interpretation of the involuntary acquisition provisions. That particular rule was vacated by the court, the District of Columbia, the Circuit Court for the District of Columbia. Basically, they said that both for lender liability and involuntary acquisition, which was the other part of this rule, that EPA didn't have any business using a rulemaking to clarify liability. That liability clarification was in the domain of the courts and not in the domain of the executive branch. In 1995, we issued some enforcement discretion guidance about involuntary acquisition, but it did not address eminent domain expressly. In 1997, Congress reinstated the 1992 rule. They basically blessed EPA's interpretation of the involuntary acquisition provisions, but it doesn't really totally resolve the question of whether eminent domain is and will always be an involuntary acquisition, which is why we urge parties to explore other paths toward protection, municipal parties to explore other paths toward protection from liability, particularly the bona fide prospective purchaser provision. If you'll turn to the next slide, number 15, we'll discuss this. The BFPP provision of the Brownfields Amendment was basically the taking of EPA's policy approach to prospective purchasers, which we implemented by entering into settlements with parties and giving them liability protection when they wanted to buy property and redevelop it. The Congress codified the bulk of our practice in that regard and made parties whose potential liability under CERCLA was solely based on being an owner or an operator of a facility liable as long as they met certain provisions. They did all appropriate inquiry so they know what they were buying, that they didn't impede the performance of a response action or natural resource restoration, and that they otherwise cooperated with the government. You'll find when you read this provision, there are a number of requirements of a party to maintain its BFPP status. But if you maintain that status by compliance with those provisions, whether you're a corporation, a redevelopment authority, or a city, you get the protection from liability that is associated with with being free, you get the protection of being free from CERCLA liability as long as you maintain that, regardless of whether or not you have any of the other defenses under CERCLA, such as involuntary acquisition or a third-party defense. And so far, we have not found any published case where where a party has been successful in challenging VFPP status. For those of you who don't live and breathe CERCLA every day, let me remind you of something I should have done earlier. In addition to EPA enforcing against parties who are liable under CERCLA and holding them responsible for cleanup,
Ken, are you still there? I think we may have lost you on the phone line. Just double checking. Jim Rocco, are you on the line?
Hi, Taylor's here.
Yes, I am. I'm on the line. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Rocco. I'm sorry, I was on mute.
No worries. Again, Ken, if you're on the line, it looks like we may have disconnected with you. Okay, well, if we can't get Ken back on the line, I think we may just have to jump forward to the next portion of the talk. So, again, Ken, are you there? Ken? I hear some phone activity. Ken, are you on the line? Well, in the essence of time, I'm going to try to contact Ken offline and follow up with him. He was on slide number 15. Unless I can get a hold of him on a different telephone line, although I think just for the sake of time, we'll move forward. Jim, would you be okay if we move on to the next portion of the talk?
Yeah, it's okay with me.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is actually, again, apologize for the inconvenience and the disruption for everyone who's online. Ken, if you're there, go ahead and feel free to speak up. Okay, so unless I can get a hold of Ken, what I'm going to suggest is everyone move ahead to slide number 24.
Hello?
Ken, is that you?
It's Ken Patterson again. I got an unexplained busy signal that I promise you was not pilot error.
Okay, no worries. We're still here. So I guess we'll hang tight and we won't jump ahead since you're back on the line with us. I apologize for the disruption, and I think where we left off was on slide number 15.
That is correct. We're on
okay.
Slide number 15.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. What I was pointing out to people or hoping to was that because of contribution litigation, often a party, whether it's a city or another type of Superfund liable party, no matter how much EPA says they will not sue the party or exercise enforcement discretion, the contribution litigation by other liable parties at the site still can wreak havoc with folks' fear of liability. And accordingly, when we say we haven't found any published case, we don't know of any place where any third party has challenged the VFPP status of an individual. The key to VFPP purchase is that they purchase with knowledge of the contamination at the site. And again, they have conducted all appropriate inquiry. If you'll go to slide 16, let me talk to you a little bit about those VFPP requirements I referred to earlier. Again, first of all, VFPP status is only for sites acquired after January 11, 2002, which was the date of the Brownfields Amendments. The party has to perform all appropriate inquiry, also known as AAI in popular parlance, prior to the time that they're buying the property. They can't have any affiliation with a liable party. And so it can't be a sham transaction to get out of liability. And then there are a number of ongoing obligations that continue after the purchase. Complying with land use restrictions, and not impeding the effectiveness of institutional controls, taking reasonable steps to prevent the release of hazardous substances, assisting and providing cooperation to EPA, and providing access, et cetera. So those are all of the requirements to maintain BSPP status. If you go to slide 17, let me remind you that there's one provision of the BSPP protection that statutory section that you need to be remain mindful of. The any entity, whether it's a local government or someone else who becomes a BSPP, may be subject to a windfall lien. If EPA is cleaning up a site and it uses its resources, its appropriated monies, to clean up the site, and a party buys that site and becomes a BSPP, and they buy it for next to nothing and turn around and sell the improved property cleaned up on the government's nickel, then EPA will have a lien to recover its costs of the cleanup. We won't have a lien to cover, to recover all the profit the guy made or the city made, but they at least get a, EPA will be made whole again. So that's just one thing, you have to remain mindful of. The windfall, lien provisions, you can settle those with the government. We have provisions where we will negotiate with you with what the proper value of that lien is and resolve that liability for you. That attaches to cities or any other entity. Let me turn to slide number 18 and talk about another one of the defenses, and that's the enforcement bar under CERCLA 128B. Congress didn't want the federal government mucking up situations where state voluntary or brownfields programs were overseeing the cleanup, and EPA jumped in to do things its way. So basically, we can't enforce against any party who is properly cleaning up at a brownfield site under a state cleanup program. And all of the ways that we do that, the agreements we maintain to oversee what those programs have in them are covered in memoranda of agreement, and we've got those in place with 20 states right now. Now, there are exceptions to that. The Fed can still step in when, despite the efforts of the party under doing its work under the brownfields or state voluntary cleanup programs, if there's an imminent substantial endangerment to human health or the environment that calls additional response actions to be necessary, EPA can step in. Or if the state asks us to, or if we learn new information that indicates that the cleanup that is underway may not be protected, we discover new contaminants or other things come to our attention that we didn't previously know about. Or if there's migration across state lines onto another state's property or property within another state or owned the property owned or maintained by the federal government. So those are exceptions to that enforcement bar protection that we could still enforce against someone despite their involvement with a state voluntary program. If you could turn to, I want to talk about one more protection that operates by virtue of statute, and that's the one I referred to earlier that has to do with situations where the municipal entity doesn't own the property, where the where a city or other local government entity has to go onto the property to take an emergency action to address a release or a threatened release of hazardous substances. In those situations, we could not hold a state or local government liable for going on to that property. Now, that doesn't apply to state and local governments if they invoke it to address releases of hazardous substances that they generated themselves or from a facility that it owned. For example, a city couldn't take all of its municipal sewage sludge that may be contaminated, put it into a landfill that someone else owned, and then go in there and claim they weren't liable because they had to go put out a fire in the landfill. If it's substances they produced or they own the facility themselves, this doesn't attach. And there has to be an absence of gross negligence or intentional misconduct on the part of state or local government. So that's the final one of the statutory provisions in place. In situations where parties have concerns about their liability at a site, there are a range of things that we can do to help address those concerns. If you'll go to the next slide, number 20. Whether or not that entity is a corporate entity, a redevelopment authority, or a city, we have entered into, for example, comfort or status letters that provide a purchaser or a current owner of a property with the information EPA currently has about a particular property and what our intentions are with respect to that property. Now, these aren't promises we'll never sue you, but they are indications as to EPA's current plans based upon the facts that they know at the time that the comfort or status letter is issued. EPA has issued and can issue ready for reuse or RFR determinations that affirm that a site's conditions are, as they currently exist, are protective of human health and the environment for certain types of reuses. For example, that a site cleaned up to industrial standards might be good for locating a steel mill, but it wouldn't cover, for example, the placement of a residence or a daycare center there. Next thing that we can do, remember when I was talking to you about the Brownfields Amendment? Excuse me a moment. I'm going to put this phone on forward so you don't hear that ringing anymore, and I apologize. All right. The next, I talked about the Brownfields, the BFPP provisions of the statute. They protect a party as long as they just own and operate the property. If a party wants to do more cleanup at the site, and that cleanup may expose them to operator liability because it's more than just reasonable steps to prevent exacerbating the contamination at the site, we will enter into BFPP doing work agreements where we give them a covenant not to sue as long as they comply with that agreement. As mentioned earlier, we will engage in lien settlements to get rid of the specter of the windfall lien. We're also available to come out and talk to prospective purchasers or developers, et cetera, about the status of a particular site and what EPA's intentions are regarding the site. And often that can be enough if a city's faced with a dilemma about what to do about a site and they're looking to get people to buy it. There are site reuse fact sheets that the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website has provided about the summary of all of the sites that have been reused. And these can serve as models for other sites that may be similarly situated in your area. And then third, EPA has done partial deletions from the national priorities list in order to address the purchase of certain less contaminated or more valuable pieces of property from a larger Superfund site. In summary, let me tell you that we do on the next slide, or the closing summary slide here, let me just urge you to keep in mind that while our mission is to protect human health and the environment, we want to do that in concert with local government, and we recognize that a site that isn't put into beneficial reuse, you got to wonder why we would have cleaned it up to begin with. And that's part of our collective job as regulators to make sure that what we clean can be reuse. So we do try to bend over backwards to accommodate municipalities, and very much appreciate that from a completely realistic perspective that all politics is local. And we don't like being called to task by your local representatives on the Hill. And we don't like to be seen as anything other than a partner in fostering responsible redevelopment, because that's honestly the truth. So, with all that, I don't have any more prepared remarks, but I'm happy to take any questions that may have come in from any of the participants.
If there's anyone on the phone lines that has an immediate question that they'd like to get asked, you can simply ask it now by unmuting your line. If you muted with the star 6, you hit pound 6 to unmute. Okay, I don't hear any questions, and there weren't any that were submitted online. Of course, everyone is welcome to continue to think about what was presented and submit comments and questions at any point in time during the session by using the question mark icon on top of your slides. You can make sure your pop-up blocker is disabled so the question form will appear if you click that button. And at the next chance, we'll actually read them out loud to the instructors on your behalf. So I think in the interest of time, we're going to continue to move on. Melissa?
Yeah, thank you, Jean. Thank you, Ken, very much for a really complete and wide-ranging discussion on CERCLA liability and local governments. I'd like to turn it over now to John Podgursky, who I believe is going to introduce Jim Rocco.
Thanks, Melissa. Excuse me. Can everybody hear me okay? Can I get a sound check?
Yep, everything sounds good. And just for the online participants, people looking at the slides, we're on slide number 24, getting ready to start the next portion of today's seminar.
Terrific, thank you. Excuse me, I'm home sick today, so you'll have to bear with me a bit. So I'm just basically going to introduce the next presentation. Region 1 has undertaken to develop a workbook that we refer to as the Risk Evaluation Workbook for Communities. This project originated in our New England region, but David Lloyd, who many of you probably know, heads up the EPA Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, does intend for this to be a national tool. And we're currently in the process of wrapping up the workbook, and we hope to have it ready for printing sometime in January. So I'd like to start off with a few basic comments about the genesis of the project before we move into it. So what we have been finding is that many municipalities are still reluctant to acquire contaminated properties. So to better understand the underlying reasons for that, we connected outreach to about 35 or 40 local and state officials in New England. Now, one of the key findings was that many local officials find it difficult to manage all the information that is out there, especially with respect to environmental liability. Excuse me. Many also felt that they weren't necessarily getting the best advice from their own town attorneys, real estate professionals, developers, and so forth, some of which who have really very limited expertise with environmental laws. So the concept behind the workbook is to provide a framework for helping local officials make decisions on whether and how to move the redevelopment of contaminated properties forward. The workbook also attempts to provide a foundation for understanding at least some of the important considerations and issues that may need to be taken into account in making those decisions. So the goal here is not to make local officials experts in any of these topics, but at least put them in a much better position to ask the right questions of the regulators and their consultants and their attorneys and others. So joining with me today are two or three key members of the project team, Rona Gregory, who I hope I was able to sign on, is Region 1's lead Brownfields attorney and is also a Superfund case attorney. And Rona's been working in this capacity for a great many years, pretty much since the inception of the EPA Brownfields program. Jim Rocco, and I don't know if Mike Taylor is
yeah,
on.
I'm here.
Mike, you're on? Okay, great. Jim and Mike are with Vita Nova, a private consulting firm with extensive expertise redeveloping contaminated properties. And importantly, they bring a lot of practical experience. They've worked with developers, property owners, municipalities, as well as the environmental regulatory agencies in the performance of all that work. So, Rona, did you want to add anything to?
I am on, John, and no, that was fine.
Okay, great. So I'm going to turn the presentation itself over to Jim Rocco from Vita Nova, and I think Mike and I will be commenting on throughout, I guess. Thanks, Jim.
Good afternoon, everyone. If everyone could make sure they're on slide 25. What I want to talk about today is the workbook and more the structure of the workbook and what's contained in the workbook rather than getting into a detailed explanation of the workbook itself. And as I go through this, if you have any questions, feel free to submit them, and I will try to answer the questions as we're going through the presentation. The place to start is really why do we need a workbook, or what is the risk management workbook? And what this workbook is designed, it's targeted to local governments, and we've just heard a presentation about CERCLA-related issues as they apply to brownfield sites, particularly as they apply to brownfield sites where local governments may need to get involved. And within this workbook, we're outlining a risk management framework, and it's really there to assess the options and prepare strategies to facilitate the cleanup and also to revitalize underused properties, underutilized properties. And we also want to recognize that there's a broad range of sites, everything from relatively small sites, such as an underground storage tank site, former service station, all the way up to very large brownfield sites that may be associated with multiple industrial activities. And so the intent of this workbook is to cover a fairly broad range.
We can move in.
Yeah.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
This is Michael Taylor. I'm going to be adding color as we go along. And what I wanted to say was that what we've tried to do is to tailor this to municipalities who are trying to get their arms around a broad set of risks, including environmental risks, and to be able to use the worksheets, which we'll be able to see, but because they're in slides, they're very small. Hopefully, you'll be able to see them later. That can be completed by the various experts that are working on these sites and put together in a way that they can be explained and used in the decision-making process that municipalities have. Currently, the risk management process within a municipality is not always a clear process. And we hope to help give them a tool that will help streamline that process. Go ahead, Jim.
And that's actually a very good lead-in to the next slide, which is really related to why do communities need this. And as Mike said, there's a risk management process that communities need to go through in order to evaluate any project, whether it's a brownfields project or whether it's construction of a new utility garage or something along those lines. But the concept is that there are risks in any project, and that in order to deal with those projects, you have to determine how to manage those risks. In the case of a brownfield sites, risk can range from environmental liability, common law liability. It can deal with financial risk, which could be a direct outcome of the environmental liability or common law liability, or other risks associated with operating, owning, or otherwise developing a property. And also political risk, which, as we use in this document, relate to what are more termed as economical and social issues that may occur as a result of acquisition or involvement in a brownfields project. And also to recognize that risk is a function of both likelihood of the risk occurring and the consequences of that risk. In other words, as the likelihood increases and the consequences increases, so does the risk. And to put that in the context of the evaluation of both the environmental liability as well as other liabilities or risks that may be associated with that property. If you move to the next slide. In addition, we want to be able to set this workbook up so that the communities can have a working knowledge of a process, the issues and the options. And as we talk a little bit more about this workbook, we try to provide a fairly broad overview of the issues and the options that are available to a community in dealing with a brownfields property. We want them to have an understanding and comfort with the liability. And it's also a recognition that every community has a different level of comfort or a different level of sensitivity with respect to various risk issues that are out there, and that only the community can decide what level of risk they're willing to assume. And to a large extent, what level of risk they're willing to assume is going to be how comfortable they are with the information available to them in making the decision. We also want to be able to provide background to support the oversight and interaction with technical advisors. Smaller communities in particular rely extensively on outside consultants, outside attorneys, and other expertise that's necessary to help them evaluate these properties. And the workbook is designed to provide them with a level of comfort to oversee those third parties, those consultants, and those attorneys. And then in addition, and sort of a very important part of this document, is to provide worksheets in the document not only to support the process, but also to document the process and help the communities work through the issues that are related to the redevelopment and be able to have something to fall back on so they can demonstrate their due diligence, essentially, in evaluating the property and working through the property.
Yeah, Jim, if I can just add, as you can imagine, when a community goes to address a brownfield, there may be a project manager in the economic development office, it may be a brownfields coordinator, it may be the head of economic development, it may be the first selectman, depending on the size of the town. And so these worksheets, if you're dealing with more than one party in a community, or you need to go to an elected body or an elected official to try to make your case, these worksheets pull together all the background information into a relatively simple process that can then be summarized to build your case for whatever the decision might be. Go ahead, Jim.
So where we go from here then is to talk a little bit about how the guide works, and I'm going to provide you with two things. One is an overview of the process that's outlined in the workbook, and then a brief view, I guess I'll say, of the worksheets that are out there. Because of the timing that we have, we don't have the time to go through these worksheets, and you'll notice that they're shown on the slides, and they may not be as readable as we'd like them to be, but the concept here is to demonstrate that there are, in fact, these worksheets out there, and these worksheets are designed to support the various process steps that we outlined. So if we could move to slide 29. There's two major assumptions or two major issues associated with this workbook. The first is that any process in evaluating a brownfield has to fit into the overall concepts and the overall process of redeveloping a property. And all those actions that you would normally go through to redevelop a property also have to be considered when you're looking at a brownfield site. And so the concept of the workbook is to place the brownfields redevelopment in the context of any redevelopment action that's out there. And so we spent some time in the workbook talking a little bit about an overview of the redevelopment process and how that risk evaluation is integrated into that process. If we move to the next slide, in addition, we provide an overview of a general risk management concept. Within any redevelopment process where there are going to be risks and liabilities associated with that redevelopment, there's a process that redevelopers go through in evaluating the potential risks associated with that. And essentially, when evaluating risks, you need to, first of all, understand and identify those risks, determine what those risks are in the context of the site that you're redeveloping, find out whether that risk is acceptable to you or not. If not, identify options to deal with that risk, reassess that risk in the context of those options, and then work through the cycle again. And the concept is eventually that you either get to a point where the risks are unacceptable and there's no options for dealing with those risks, or you've found options to address those risks to make those acceptable for purposes of the redevelopment or for purposes of the decision that NET
Tim, can I just jump in for a second? This is John. We just have a question up on the screen. It's an important, actually important point to make. The question basically wonders whether the risk management workbook that we're talking about applies only to brownfields or would it also apply to Superfund sites. And that's a very critical point. It applies basically to all contaminated sites. So if we refer to brownfields, we really mean contaminated sites. Thanks, Jim.
Yes, and that is a good point. And in this case, what we're really looking at is essentially any site in which you may be dealing with an environmental condition of some sort, whether it's related to a Superfund site or a brownfield site. It doesn't really matter in the process. I want to spend a few seconds talking about the evaluation process in a general sense and then going through it in a little bit more detail. What you see now on the next slide is the evaluation process. And the process essentially starts by establishing some goals, screening the options that you have for dealing with that property, conducting due diligence, identifying the goals, identifying obstacles, risks, and potential tools to deal with those risks in the context of those obstacles, and then ultimately selecting an option for dealing with the property. And we'll go through some of those in a little bit more detail. If you go to the next slide, we talk specifically about establishing project goals. And goals are essentially the desired outcome of the redevelopment. What is it you as a community want to see happen as a result of this development? And in some cases, it may be specifically to get it back into some economically viable use. In other cases, it may be very specific uses that the community has in mind. And the community may have a specific option, such as they want to convert it into parkland, or they want to be able to build a municipal building on it, or they might want to be able to develop a commercial center or something along those lines. So it's important right on the front end to understand the outcome that you expect to have with this. In addition,
Jim, just as you can imagine, in a municipality, if you're handed, go and deal with this brownfield site, many, many times it's not clearly articulated what it is that needs to be accomplished. That's why EPA promotes the idea of stakeholder involvement, wants to see that that's been done on the site, and that these goals are not only articulated but vetted as a part of the process. So we've embedded this opportunity for stakeholder engagement into the guide. Go ahead, Jim.
In addition, we also want to consider the importance or the priority of the redevelopment, and then also any time-critical issues that are associated with that redevelopment. And time-critical issues could be related to the redevelopment or to other issues associated with the property itself. Once you've gone through and established your goals, if we move to the next slide, what we have in here is a worksheet. And the context of this worksheet is to provide essentially a whiteboard, if you want to call it that, for writing down those things that you've identified as part of your goal-setting process. And the worksheets will identify some of the key issues that are generally associated with goal-setting, such as just the general issues with the property, understanding the, parcels and parcel size and zoning and those kind of things. But also to get to those three primary questions with respect to the reuse goals, and that is, what is the desired outcome, how necessary is the development, and how time critical is the redevelopment. So worksheet one is designed to document those issues that help support the goals that have been set for the property. If we look to the next portion of this, as part of setting those goals, one of the other things that is important to understand is the preliminary reuse assessment. And as Mike mentioned earlier, it's a way to be able to take a look at this property, to engage stakeholders in the process, and to get a good feel for not only what do you want to be able to use the property for, but also what can the property be used for. And a reuse assessment is not something that's unique to the to a brownfields or a Superfund type site. It's a type of assessment that's done on any type of redevelopment in order to understand whether that redevelopment is going to be a viable redevelopment for that particular property. In this case, and in the case of a brownfields redevelopment, it also provides you with the ability to look at the initial constraints and market conditions that may be associated with that property. There is a question out there as to whether the workbooks can be downloaded now. And I think, as John mentioned earlier in his introduction, our hope is to have the workbook available in January, early January. And when that occurs, I believe, John, that it will be able to be downloaded.
Yeah, excuse me, Jim. Yeah, that's correct. We're hoping to have this online as well as having hard copies.
Okay. If we look to the next slide, with respect to the reuse assessment, what we have provided is a worksheet that does have a list of questions that are generally associated with reuse assessment. And I'm not going to go through all of these questions that are here. You can see those questions on the slide, but they deal with information such as what are the potential reuses for the site. It looks at things as to whether the community has addressed things like needs assessments, opportunities and constraints analysis, and so on and so forth. And again, the purpose of this worksheet is really to define or document that information that would be pertinent to a reuse assessment.
And Jim, one thing just to say that none of these worksheets are intended to necessarily be exhaustive. We think we've probably covered a significant portion of the major issues that will come up under each of these, but we're going to create the opportunity for anyone using the workbook to add any additional information that's pertinent to the property that they're specifically dealing with.
That's correct. And again, as I said, these worksheets are designed to provide guidance and documentation, but clearly there are going to be issues associated with a particular redevelopment that are not going to be specifically covered by these worksheets. The next step in the evaluation process is a preliminary screening of property recovery actions. And by property recovery actions, what we're really referring to are those actions a municipality may wish to take with respect to a redevelopment of a brownfields facility. And if you look on the right-hand side of the slide, we show a relationship of essentially control versus risk relationship. In other words, the more control that a community or a municipality may want to have on a redevelopment, the more risk they may have to be willing to assume, or at least the more risk they will have to be able to be willing to address as part of the redevelopment. And if you look at some of these property recovery actions, they range from acquisition and long-term retention of the property, where the municipality may wish to control the property, for instance, to build a municipal building or something along those lines, and so they may wish to acquire that property and obviously retain it for a long period of time, to less control, less risky options, which may deal with just creating some sort of market or some other type of incentive for the redevelopment for those properties. And so, again, the involvement of the municipality in that redevelopment can vary, and it's going to depend on their initial goals, and it's also going to depend on their sensitivity to the risks that can be assumed or would have to be assumed with respect to a redevelopment. The next stage of the process, let me back up. The third worksheet that here, again, summarizes the preliminary screening of these various recovery options. And essentially, it's designed to walk the municipality through the evaluation of various options and identify whether one or more options are options that they wish to consider. One of the concepts in this workbook is that you could have multiple options for dealing with a particular facility or particular property, and the community or the municipality may wish to evaluate all of these various options to determine which option is most beneficial to them or which option seems most reasonable for them to move forward with. And as a result, the concept is to identify one or more options for purposes of evaluation. The workbook also assumes that as you move through the process, that it may become obvious that certain options are not going to be acceptable, and they can be dropped out of the process early in the evaluation, and that options that are more likely to be successful can be carried through for more detail. So the worksheet is designed to work you through those types of considerations. If we move on to actually two slides up to the slide on dealing with due diligence, this is probably the most important part of the evaluation process. And when we talk about due diligence in the context of this workbook, while the workbook tends to focus on the environmental due diligence, because that's really the issue of most concern with the municipalities, it also reminds people that there's a lot of other due diligence that goes along with dealing with a property. And so there are conventional real estate due diligence issues, such as clear title, liens on the property, property appraisals, a variety of other actions that are addressed to some extent in the workbook, but they're not defined as detailed as the environmental due diligence. Specifically, the workbook does go through the due diligence related to things like the phase one and the phase two environmental assessments, the all appropriate inquiry, and the use of that, dealing with things like the property itself, the environmental condition, remedial action, regulatory status, environmental restrictions, as I mentioned, the all appropriate inquiry. And as with the other sections, we do have a fairly detailed set of worksheets that go with the due diligence. If you look at the next few pages or next few slides, you'll see that we do have essentially a checklist to go through and provide the community or the municipality with a checklist that they can go through to determine whether, for the most part, major issues associated with due diligence have been addressed. And as Mike mentioned earlier, this worksheet is not designed to be complete, to be extensive in the sense of being able to be used to make your demonstration for all appropriate inquiry, but it does provide the community with a checklist, with a list of information, questions that can be asked to their consultants, to their attorneys, and to help them work through the due diligence process to determine whether the due diligence process is addressing the issues that need to be addressed with respect to the property. And this sheet is a fairly extensive sheet. It runs a couple of pages long, as you will see, which takes us to the next slide. And, Mike, I believe you have a comment.
Yeah, just one of the problems, if you've, you know, dealt with technical versus non-technical people, is that consultants will go, they'll do the work, they'll come in with a big report, they'll put their recommendations in, et cetera. But to the layman, it's a big, thick report that they're not sure what to do with. And we think that using this checklist, it'll help them sharpen the questions that they need to ask their consultant, and or it'll force their consultant to put the major issues down on a piece of paper that clearly lays out what they are for their client, and then in turn that individual within the municipality can then use that to help explain and help other people within the municipality understand what the issues are. So we hope it opens up the process and helps everybody become a part of the risk communication that needs to go on as a part of this process.
Jim, can I just make one point of clarification? Just so folks understand, in the manual, we have an entire chapter on environmental due diligence. And for each of the bullets you see on this worksheet, there is a discussion where, at a minimum, we try to frame the question so that the municipal official at least understands why that question might be important and some of the implications of it.
Yes, and And I think that's very important in the overall context of the workbook. What we do try to do within the workbook, and there are chapters devoted to each of these topics as we move through them that help provide some background and information associated with the topic as well as with the worksheet itself. And the chapters generally parallel the worksheets as far as the information presented. One of the other things about the worksheets, in particular this due diligence worksheet, is it's also designed to identify other due diligence questions that may be out there. And as I mentioned earlier, we're not, with respect to due diligence, we want to make it clear in the document that due diligence goes beyond just environmental due diligence. There is other due diligence that needs to be considered in evaluating a property. And that this worksheet is also a way to track those other questions and issues that are raised as you go through the evaluation process. One other thing that I didn't mention earlier, that is an important component of this evaluation process, is that it is designed to be an iterative process. In other words, we would not expect that all of the information that is necessary to make a decision on a property is going to be available the first time you get involved, the first time you look at the property. But the concept is to work through these various steps, these various stages of the process, identify the information that's available, determine whether that information is acceptable, and identify what information is still out there. And as you look at this next slide, well, we go through the process, we've gone through our due diligence, and now we have some information. And the first time through, we may only have a phase one environmental site assessment, and there may not be any history with respect to the environmental condition on a property. And as you go through that, what you are going to do is identify what are the obstacles that the information that you have presents. And one of the obstacles may be there's not enough information there to determine whether there's obstacles. I don't know a lot about the environmental condition. Once you've identified the obstacles, you also want to look at are there any gaps associated with the information that help me better understand those obstacles. And if you move to the next slide, you'll see we've designed a worksheet to help document the obstacles that are out there, the priority of those obstacles, and then any information that's important to understanding those obstacles. We also recognize in the workbook that while you may identify obstacles that are associated with a particular site, some obstacles may be more important to than others to address. And so we also suggest as you move through this process that you prioritize your obstacles so that if you have to look at things like additional data collection and those kind of things, you focus that on the high priority items, not necessarily the low priority items. That's a way of focusing not only resources, but also finances as well. And
hey, Jim,
so as we move...
Jim, can I just jump in? Just
sure.
Let folks know, I believe we're on slide 44 right now.
Oh.
Can you confirm that, Jim?
Yes. That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. If we move on, moving to slide 45... The second part of this evaluation process is really to look at the economics and conduct a financial analysis. Once you understand some of the obstacles, you can start putting some financial cost to those obstacles, and you can start looking at the value of the redevelopment in the context of what we know. And so the next step in this is really to start looking at the economics, to look at a financial analysis. And to that extent, if we move on to slide 46, there's two things that we provide in this document. The first is what I'll call a simplified pro forma. And the concept behind the pro forma is essentially to look at the income and expense associated with a particular redevelopment to see where you are financially, whether the property is upside down, in other words, it's going to cost you more than the value, or whether the property has some economic return associated with it. And when we look at these pro formas again, we would expect that these pro formas get filled out on an iterative basis, in the sense that you do your analysis based on the information you have, and then you adjust the pro forma as you gain more information and get a better feel for the cost that may be associated with the particular property.
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
We call this the back of the envelope pro forma. I know Melissa has taken the real estate course that we did for EPA, and essentially it comes out of that work of trying to simply simplify the pro forma process that a developer would go through. Municipalities do this sort of thing. They sometimes have, when they're actually in the process of purchasing a property, they'll have a consultant who will do all kinds of financial analysis, and the idea is simply so that they can start plugging in numbers and looking at some of the options to kind of see where they are above or below the break-even line.
And tied with this pro forma is also the concept of doing a sources and use of funds analysis. As we're starting to work through the process, the questions that need to be asked are, where is the money going to come from to do the things that need to be done? And then how is that money going to be spent, or what am I going to use those funds for? In some cases, particularly when we're dealing with grants and such funds, there may be very specific uses or limitations on the uses for those funds. And so you need to understand where that money is coming from and what limitations may be tied to that money, and make sure that that money is used in the areas that it's supposed to be used. And the sources and use evaluation is a way of going through that type of analysis.
And again, this is a tool that municipalities use all the time. We're really just referencing it so that the risk management approach is in the context of the work that they would normally do. So anytime they would look at acquiring a property, they would have someone create this, or they would create something like this themselves, and it's all part of their acquisition and or development process. What we try to do is to link risk management issues, environmental costs, other things that may be outside of what they typically do into the process that they normally carry out.
Exactly. Once we've gone through this financial analysis, the next step in the process is to assess the project risks. What are the risks associated with it? As I mentioned earlier, we've identified a series of obstacles. An obstacle may be an environmental condition exists on the site. And the risk may be, if I buy this property, I will have to clean it up. Or if I redevelop the property, I will have to clean it up. Those are the kind of things that we need to start looking at once we've identified those obstacles. Another obstacle could be potential circle of liability and the risks associated with that. And so once we've identified our obstacles, then we need to start looking at what are the risks that are tied to those obstacles. And that is the subject of our next worksheet, which is our sixth worksheet in this document, which is slide 49. And again, this worksheet is designed to document those barriers or obstacles that have been identified, what their priority are, and essentially in a lot of these, we bring all of the information from one shit worksheet to another. For instance, you'll notice on worksheet 6 that some of the information from worksheet 5 is carried along into the next worksheet.
Jim, can you talk for a second, Jim?
Sure.
Just before we leave this notion of environmental liability risk, just to let you know that we dedicate a chapter and a good portion of the appendix to discussing environmental liability. We talk about CERCLA. We talk about some of the other key cleanup statutes, various subtitles of RCRA, some provisions of TSCA. And so just to let you know, there's a chapter that a lot of the types of tools that Ken had spoken about earlier are summarized within that chapter for CERCLA. And there's also discussion so that the local officials have some understanding of the other regulatory programs that may come into play. Thanks, Jim.
Correct. Okay. Moving along, and actually the next slide is just a continuation of the previous worksheet. If you move to slide 51, the last step in this process then is to evaluate the risk management tools themselves. What tools are available to address a particular risk? And at this point, what we do in the document, and we have a chapter devoted to risk management tools that deal with all sorts of tools that range from contractual issues to various liability minimization issues through insurance and a variety of other options that are available that can help minimize or eliminate risks. And it's an important point that we make in the document that it is not always possible to eliminate risk. In many cases, your best bet is to find those options that minimize risk to a level that's acceptable to the community. And these tools, as I mentioned, are outlined with some brief description associated with each of those tools on how they can be used. The last worksheet that's associated with this document, which is on the next page, is really the final worksheet that takes through what the obstacles are, what the risks associated that are, and what management tools are available to address those risks, and whether that management tool does in fact acceptably address the risk that's been identified. Once you've gotten through this process, where you are in the process now is to be able to look at the overall process and go back and determine whether a particular option, recovery option, is appropriate or not. And if we look on slide 53, we're down to the point of selecting the property recovery options. And to go back a little bit and sort of review this, as I mentioned, we start out with what are the obstacles and considerations, what are the project cost considerations and financial analysis, and what are the risks that are associated with that. Those all feed into the project goals, and the question you're asking yourself at that point is the four questions that are in the box under core questions, which says, will the selected property recovery action achieve the project goal? Can I achieve the project goal? Is it financially viable and realistic? Do we have the resources available to do it? And are the risks acceptable based on the tools and the risks that have been identified?
Jim?
Yeah.
I just want to say that, you know, it may appear to you, not having looked at the document, that this is sort of an automatic process, that if you just fill out these worksheets, somehow these issues and these actions will pop out. And that's absolutely not the impression that we're trying to give. It's merely a matter of trying to help organize and facilitate a better risk management discussion that certainly is happening anyway, and many times in a much more informal, and I'm afraid to say it, John, you can make your comments with regard to feedback you've received, a somewhat haphazard way within municipalities. And what it does is it allows the project manager, the person who controls these worksheets, the ability to get input and feedback from people below them, above them, consultants outside of them, EPA personnel, attorneys that may be inside attorneys or external attorneys, and put all that information into one place. Whereas without these worksheets, it's a cumbersome process. Let's just say that it's a cumbersome process anyway. We hope we're providing some means to help organize it a little better. And John, I don't know if you want to comment on some of the feedback you've received earlier in from municipalities looking at these guidance, this guidance.
No, I think that essentially captures it, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah. By the way, very quickly, we have a comment asking for to identify who's speaking. So let me just say I'm John Tigerski. I'm the Region 1 Land Revitalization Coordinator, and Mike Taylor, who's the president of Vita Nova, and Jim Rocco is also with Vita Nova. Jim is doing the primary presentation.
Okay. If you move to slide 54, and actually sort of in the context of Mike's comments about the process itself, this is really a flow chart that takes you through the last three worksheets that we've gone through. And I, as Mike said, I think it's very important to understand that what we're trying to do is to provide sort of an organized process for dealing with something that, you know, sometimes can be a very haphazard process as well. But all more important is there's a lot of underlying work within those worksheets, and the concept of those worksheets is to document all of that information, or at least provide a methodology for documenting that information, so that you can go back and look at where you came from. We also look at it from the standpoint that at some point in time, somebody has to make a recommendation to management, whether it be the city council, the city manager, the mayor, and that recommendation needs to be supported by the information that generally should be associated with those worksheets. And so it also provides the background for that type of recommendation. But what I think you can see from this flowchart is there are a lot of decisions that fit into these worksheets and into this process. In this case, worksheet 5, the top, the blue area, deals with the obstacles or barriers. Worksheet 6, which deals with identifying the risks, and then worksheet 7, which identifies the risk management tools that are out there. And this is essentially the process that people are taken through in the guidance document to help make those decisions on a particular recovery option that's out there. The last slide I want to throw up, slide 55, and I recognize that we've gone through this very quickly and probably have not provided you with a lot of meat with respect to this workbook. I can assure you there is a lot of meat in this workbook. It is designed to be as comprehensive as reasonable, and also to provide the guidance that a municipality will need in order to work through these processes. And to the extent that the document itself doesn't provide the detail, we also have within the appendices of this document, in particular, much more detailed discussion of various regulatory programs and some of the issues associated with those regulatory programs, such as CERCLA, RCRA, TSCA, some of the Clean Air Act provisions, and so on, and also some additional references to other documents, both EPA documents as well as other documents that address issues pertinent to the redevelopment of these types of properties. The one thing I'd like to end with respect to the workbook is we are doing a session at the Brownfields 2009 conference. It'll be on Tuesday morning at 10:30, and we're going to go through this document in a little bit more detail. We're going to base it on a case study to go through the process, go through the completion of the worksheets, and speak in a little bit more detail about the information that is contained in the workbook. And so I encourage those that are going to be at the Brownfields Conference to attend this session. As I said, it will be on Tuesday at 10:30. And you'll see on your screen now, if you're on slide 55, you should be seeing the invitation for that. To the extent those of you in the audience that work with municipalities, I would also encourage you to encourage the municipalities to have a representative attend these sessions because I think they would be very helpful for them, particularly smaller communities that are interested in dealing with both Superfund and other brownfields related properties.
And Jim, we should say it will not be on the typical schedule for the Brownfield Conference. So if you look later and say, oh, I want to go to that session, it won't be there. This is an extra room that was set up for this event. So make sure and get the information from here and email us and let us know that you're coming, that sort of thing, and we'll keep in touch. But it's room 225.
And one other issue, and I back up and apologize to some extent that the worksheets that are shown in these slides are difficult to read, and it was not our intention at this point to be able to go through all of those worksheets in any detail. Our hope was just to demonstrate that there are in fact worksheets out there, but as we go through this demonstration at the conference, we will obviously go through the worksheets in much more detail and provide worksheets as a basis for the presentations.
And Jim, let me just jump in quickly to point out that the phone number on this invite actually for me is wrong. This is John Podgursky again. So if you want to just mark down, if you want to give me a call, if you have any further questions about the workbook, have any suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. But my actual phone number is 617-918-1296.
And Mike, the email address that's on there is to send an email to register for the session?
That's right. It'll just be helpful to know that people are coming, and if there are any changes or anything like that, we'll be sure to let you know. Because it's an extra session at Brownfields, it would be good to have an idea who's coming and to keep in touch to make sure everybody knows where to go.
And unless there's any other comments from Mike or John, I think that about wraps it up.
If this is a reminder, if there's anyone on the phone lines that has a comment or question for the speakers, if you've muted your line, simply hit #6 to unmute. Okay, I don't see any additional questions that were coming in online. Melissa, do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, I want to thank our panel. I want to thank Ken Patterson, and I want to thank John Podgursky, especially who's at home sick and called in. That is above and beyond. And also Mike Taylor and Jim Rocco, and your session sounds very interesting at Brownfield. So, and I assume everybody's available should people have questions that they could email you and talk to you. So we look forward to hearing more about this. I want to thank you all for participating and for making your presentations, and I know this is a topic we'll hear more of. This is only the beginning. So thank you all very much, and one more reminder that our next session is December 10th. Hope to hear from you all again soon. Thank you.
And I'll just make one final reminder. If you kick up to the very final slide in the presentation, slide number 56, it has those two links we mentioned earlier, the links to additional resources, which will bring you to a page that has not only today's seminar materials, but also links to a number of other websites and relevant information resources on these topics. And then just a final request, if you can take a moment or two to fill out the feedback form, I do personally read each and every one of these, and they do help to continue the delivery of these free online information sessions through the Cleanup Information Network. So with that, I also echo my thanks to the instructors, to the organizers, and to our attendees today, and remind you that you can check cluein.org for the archive session in about 2 weeks to replay.
And I want to thank Jean Balin, who's been our host extraordinaire.
Thanks so very much, guys, and I think that's going to wrap everything up. Have a great afternoon.